Hello, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 7 of Our Voices, Our Community. Each week, we focus on issues that are important to you and our community. We discuss social, political, and economic issues, but also arts and culture and much more. Our goal is to merge local with state and national issues that affect our lives in Roanoke, the New River Valley, and Southwest Virginia. Today, we are joined by Will Solari, Catherine Stromberg, and Karen Jones. Welcome, everyone.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. We need coffee today?
More coffee?
More coffee.
It's a little early this morning.
It is a little early. We're actually taping this episode just a little earlier than our usual time, so I think we're just waking up a little bit. Well, I do appreciate all of you of coming today. Our focus today will be on the closings and furloughs, issues that's been going on in our community, the cost of paying for health care, and the Suicide Prevention Month. But first, this week marks the 18th year since 9/11, which was really a very horrible event that happened in our nation. And I guess we can go around the corner here and talk about where were you, and do you remember where were you at 9/11, and what do you think has changed since that event has happened?
Well, I remember being in St. Louis, and I remember a colleague of mine who was a healthcare provider or in training to become a healthcare provider. And I recall that his response was that we should just like nuclear bomb Afghanistan. And I knew then that we were headed to hell. And lo and behold, you know, all these
Here
years, 18 years later, and, you know, two forever wars, that was pretty accurate. And a friend of mine who was also in St. Louis at the time, a Serbian, she said, like, you cannot bomb people into peace. And, you know, she was right. So there we are. Mm-hmm. You know, there was not just 9/11, but also our response to it that I had a feeling would be catastrophic, and it was.
Yeah.
I just remember I was at work, and at this time, we didn't have TVs. We just had, what was that horrible music that you would buy? Muzak.
Muzak.
So the Muzak had been playing, and so I didn't know until my friend picked me up from work and was like, did you hear what happened? And I was like, no, what? And I just remember watching on TV the devastation and could not fathom that this happened here, you know, in this place that we consider to be safe. And all of our faults and failures that something so devastating and tragic happened in New York, and then in, where was the other flight? Headed to
or from
DC?
Heading to
the Pentagon. So then that's super close to home. And I remember thinking, because at the time I also had a friend working at the Pentagon and was frantic because I wasn't sure. You know, I just knew that's where he worked. And so it was really hard thing to really wrap your head around, just the total devastation and kind of this loss of who we are.
Yeah.
Who we are.
Yeah. What about you, Will?
Yeah, I remember I was recording till like 6 in the morning on September 11th. Went home, went to bed, and the guy I was recording with immediately called me somewhere around 7 or 8 and was like, oh man, someone just flew a plane into the Pentagon. You should turn the news on. And I was like, this is a really poorly worded joke. And it's like, whoop. Mm-hmm. And then got up a little bit later and then saw everything that was happening. I had just gotten back from, I'd been in South America a long time before that. And it was this nice breather from George Bush, who I really, I just philosophically disagreed with on so many levels at the time. And kind of, you know, Catherine, like your kind of worrisome, you know, look at what was unfolding. I just remembered like, oh God, this is only going to get so much worse with this person in charge. Cause you know, wartime presidents for better or worse stay in power forever. And then again, have basically, unquestioned, decision-making powers. And it sort of set the stage for this, you know, for where we're at now. Mm-hmm. And I even remember thinking at the time, like, I should just go back to Ecuador. Like, I just need to get out of the U.S.
Yeah. Would have saved you a lot of heartache.
Yeah, more or less. Yeah. And, you know, and again, and it did. Like, I have friends to this day who, you know, what are we, 18 years later?
Yeah, 18 years.
You know, are just now recovering from, it's not entirely gone, but the post-traumatic stress or the alcoholism or all the things that came out of just, you know, wanting to get a GI Bill to go to college. And then they were, you know, shipped off to Afghanistan. They were shipped off to Iraq, all these places where we were fighting these endless, like, ideological wars. And I think that, you know, 9/11 and the tragedy and everything that, and the, all the positive ways it brought the country together. I mean, we're still paying for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was in Seattle when that happened, and actually, that was the time I actually left. I was leaving the corporate world to start my business. Ooh. And so I remember waking up happy because, you know, I was like, I'm out of the corporate world. I grabbed my cup of coffee. I'm going down to the basement to start working. Business was working. I was starting my business out of the basement at the time. And so I'm thinking that I'm starting to work. I'm starting to go into my work, and my daughter, it was actually home, she was sick, and she's watching the TV, and she said, "Daddy, the buildings are crumbling." And I didn't know what I didn't know what she was talking about. So I went up and I saw what was going on, and I just couldn't believe it. I thought it was coming from a movie when I saw that, and then to see the other plane come. It reminded me how precious life is and how quickly life can be quickly taken away so rapidly. And then to see the aftermath and see all the hard workers from the fire and police and the rescue workers coming in and trying to save lives in there. Doing that, it was pretty remarkable about human behavior and human crisis. So it's been devastating. Like you said, Catherine, we've gone through two wars,
yeah,
forever wars. I guess that's what you call it.
Yeah.
And so I'm pretty sure they're going to do something special in memory and memorialize this. I'm a little hesitant how our favorite president will present this, but I hope it's with somewhat of some kind of dignity in this.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like our current president, his Islamophobia, I mean, his stoking of all our xenophobia and everything is directly tied back to that moment. I mean, you know, as much as I also could not stand George Bush, he somewhat ameliorated that, but then, I mean, of course, he also started two wars, so didn't really, you know, in the long term, he set into play decisions that that caused us to come here, no matter how his personal affect in terms of, you know, trying to tamp down some Islamophobia was there. So
yeah,
well, you know, speaking of our Commander in Chief, it's just incredible. You know, I think 9/11 also starts this sort of information war, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sort of war on truth, and whether it's lying about weapons of mass destruction or about you know, the intents of Muslim Americans or whatever else, it becomes this, like, this playbook for where we're at now. I mean, you know, Donald Trump talking about how he was down there with the first responders,
right,
on 9/11, which is just, you know, as a civilian, which he was at the time, it's just false. There's no reason on earth he would have ever been down there, no matter how much money he had or clout or whatever else. And it's just, it's sort of ridiculous.
And it was not one of his buildings either.
Right.
No. I mean, there's no reason.
No.
It was none of his buildings.
But it was a real, I think there is a real message there. You know, there was an artist who got in a lot of trouble for saying that, you know, the attack on the World Trade Centers was one of the greatest works of art ever. And I don't think what he meant by that he was celebrating, but as a message about corporate interest, about, you know, money controlling a place, you know, and again, it becomes this kind of battle of religious ideology versus capitalism. Mm-hmm. And as a symbol of that, I mean, I think that's still something we all should deeply reflect on still. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the war in Afghanistan, everything with Halliburton, how we got and to where we're at now is started by a group of people who see us as wealthy and see us as driven by money and all these things, and made this very violent statement about it. And we're just like, oh, it's because they hate our freedom. It's because of this and that. And we really sort of, you know, I don't agree with anything that happened throughout the entire, you know, day of September 11th. But I think we should reflect on, you know, if we do go into someone's countries and create these power vacuums, if we do go and, you know, push our beliefs or our way of life or especially our financial and corporate interest on other places, you know, bad things can happen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So one kind of, you know, funny thing about me is that I had taken a bunch of classes in college on Islam. And so I actually knew more than like the average, you know, bare American educated college student, because I had taken, I think, 3 different Islam classes in college in the religion department at William & Mary. And I really enjoyed all 3 of those classes. They were incredibly educational. But one of the things that I did learn in one of those classes was the very all the sects and all the things that, you know, I think a lot of people still don't understand about Islam and how it is as a religion was sort of exploited by the Saudis in terms of creating this ideology that they used to they funded the religious extremism and ideology that then, you know, and we're their allies. And I think we never grappled with the fact that, you know, we looked at this as an outside attack, but you could also see it as like domestic, like our ally, you know. It's almost like, mm-hmm. you know, these are our allies and they funded this group in order to control their own country. And then when you look at what sort of rich people in our country are out there funding groups that are extremist to control us, you think, whoa, you know, we've got a lot more in common with these, you know, Saudi princes sometimes than we like to admit in terms of our own, you know, how we get manipulated here.
Mm-hmm. Proxy, yeah. I mean, all those proxy wars that essentially come down to trade and money.
Yeah, it's about money. Yeah. It is. At the end of the day, it is. So we do hope that we honor, especially this day, correctly and by our government, your favorite, Catherine, your favorite president.
Well, you know, there is. So, but well, we were listening to the radio this morning, and my girlfriend mentioned, she's like, it's you know, it's amazing to hear all these senators on here who, despite whatever the interview is about, be like, hey, we need to take a moment and reflect on 9/11, and make sure our flags are out, and make sure we got our yellow ribbons on and all that stuff, and. Jessica was like, aren't these the same guys who couldn't show up for the first responders, like, vote
right.
or hearing?
Passing.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Please, you know, thoughts and prayers again from a lot of these politicians. Yep. So
yeah. Right. I think it's important that we remember we have to take care of those that take care of us.
Yes.
And we know that our first responders always put their lives or put our lives ahead of their lives, and particularly everyone who works so hard during 9/11 and all the aftermath. We have to remember that we have to take care of them, whatever the cost, whatever the financial cost of that is that we have to take care of them and their families, because they're going to be suffering for a while, and we've seen that.
Yeah.
So
all right. Well, let's start talking about some local and regional issues. This week, Norfolk Southern announced another furlough.
Mm-hmm.
Norfolk Southern has been a mainstay in our community for many years. We have Ballast.
Thank you, because I can't say it either.
I can't say it. I have Ballast Point.
But I can't say the other one either.
I know it's in Botetourt.
Right.
Ballast Point in Botetourt. Say that 10 times. And it's closing. Deschutes Brewery announced a few months ago that they are indefinitely delaying construction. So all these great economic ventures were coming into our community we were excited about. Now they're starting to run away. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's going on here?
Well, so the Ballast Point, I don't know, you know, that the brewery is going to keep going. So I think they're going to continue to brew. So their production is going to remain, it's the restaurant side that's closing down, which, you know, it was kind of a far drive to go, you know, in terms of being out there. You know, it was nice. It was a lovely location. I'd been out there maybe twice, and it wasn't something, I mean, you have to drive. Like, that's the thing from, you know, most people who live, you know, the main people who live, you know, in Roanoke City, and, you know, the main, you know, most highly, the densest populated area would have to drive all the way out there. And, you know, you have to drive all the way out there to drink alcohol. And then
there's other options on the way before you get to
there.
I mean, there's so, other points. I mean, if you want a chicken sandwich, you can actually go around the corner to get that sandwich instead of driving, 10 miles.
I think it's Daleville. It's not even off the interstate, right? Don't you have to, can you get off of it?
It's not that far off the interstate. Okay. I mean, it's like 5-10 minutes once you get off the interstate. But yeah, it was a drive. I mean, I'm such a city person. I'm like, oh, it's more than 5 minutes. It's so far away.
You know, that's funny. You know, when I first came home, I used to drive from Seattle. I mean, anywhere you go, it's a 30-minute drive wherever you go in Seattle. And I am mad and pissed every time I go. And I go, and it's like on a daily basis. I don't think about it. I know I have to go to a restaurant. It's 30 minutes away. I don't have a problem with that. Now that I'm home, I have to go to Kroger, which is a like 7-minute drive. I'm sitting here like, what the hell?
That's okay. Yeah. I'm always like, I have to go all the way to Blacksburg.
Yeah.
Oh, such a long drive.
I know, and I'm being pampered now. That now if I go less than 5 minutes, I'm upset that I'm going somewhere. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, living in Texas for a long time, it was kind of the same deal. You know, it's like you got to drive 3 hours to get to another town in Texas. It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think when you're looking at places like Ballast, especially places that were capital ventures, right? Whether it's Deschutes, and whether it's, you know, like Norfolk and you're scaling back, you know, if you look at a kind of Roanoke recession, that's playing out everywhere. You know, breweries had a bubble. It was going to be the next hot thing. So obviously there was a lot of investing, a lot of growth with that. And that was going to pop. Everyone sort of knew that. But, you know, a friend called me the other day and he's like, hey, man, you still collecting silver? And I was like, yeah, why? I mean, and I just sort of casually buy silver every now and then because it's something my uncle did. And I just thought it'd be a fun way to, you know, leave my kids something other than debt. And and so they're like, silver is way up. And I was like, what? Because silver hadn't done anything in years. But silver like shot up to like $19. And it's because everyone is knowing that, you know, again, I'm not just trying to like blame the president for everything, but, you know, we're headed towards an economic crisis, probably. We're heading towards another recession thanks to all this, these great tax cuts and all these great trade wars and all these things that, you know, are damaging our country. And so what you see, you know, you hear about farmers getting affected by, you know, and that's kind of silly. You're like, yeah, you voted for them. But now it's kind of the trickle down economics has gotten to us. You know, the smaller places, the extensions of a prosperous business. I'm just going to keep using Ballast for this example. You know, the friendly public facing side, the restaurant and tasting area, which was beautiful. All that's got to go away because everybody's got to scale back now because the tax cuts didn't work because our trade agreements or, you know, our trade war with China is starting to have, you know, global effects rather than just our poor farmers growing soy.
Yeah, the stock market right now, I mean, if you have any nerves in dealing with the stock market, you've lost it because it's going up and down on a daily basis. And with the tariffs in China, mm-hmm. that tariff war going with China, I mean, it's and it's not, and we're not winning it. We're not winning. I don't care what they do. We're not winning. I mean, we're losing billions of dollars toward that. And now you have locally and regionally, you have all these businesses just now kind of floating away slowly. It does, like you said, Will, it does feel like we're being, it's like, I feel like it's a setup. You see this train coming and it's like, oh my God, this train is coming. What are we going to do? Are we going to stand in the middle of it and get run over? Or what are we going to do? Are we going to try to stop it or divert it? But I think next year, and I hate to, I know it's an election year, it might save us a little bit because it's an election year, but I really believe that we're going to have some form of financial crisis going in 2020.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I just hope that we are, I don't know, that we start to have a different philosophy about, you know, we talk a lot about money and spending on here and, you know, corporate money. But one, you know, and one of the things that corporations do is that they only care about making more money when, like, that's not necessarily always the best thing. Like, you know, there's just so many, like, we've worshipped the market for so long, and we've worshipped growth and corporations as these, like, models of efficiency, but they're really not at all. Like, you know, when I think about what's efficient, you know, I'm my training, right, is an immunologist. So when I think about what's efficient, I think vaccines are efficient. Like, mm-hmm. this is a way that's, like, super low cost, like, super low risk to stop things. Like, you know, just this morning, I'm reading this story. There's HPV vaccine, and we could, you know, this is like the most amazing cancer drug basically that's ever been invented. Like, it can stop so many cancers, and we don't have full uptake of it. We only have, like, you know, there's like a, we have a very small percentage of people compared to the number of kids that are supposed to be getting it that are getting it. I'm thinking, like, what is it that we're stopping? But then I look at all the immunotherapy drugs and the cancer immunotherapy drugs that you can, you know, once a kid gets cancer or once an adult gets cancer, you can, you know, charge them out the wazoo for. Well, those are big, big business, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, we just, I don't know, we have to look at our whole economy and what is efficiency, and we have to start measuring everything differently, because mm-hmm. right now we're measuring everything in terms of, like, corporate profits, mm-hmm. and that just cannot be how we measure how we're doing, mm-hmm. you know? We have to measure it in terms of well-being of people, I think, and then we might have a more holistic, I don't know. And so I just hope that we're able to, I mean, I don't think we're transitioning over into, you know, the well-being index anytime soon. Right. But I just hope we manage to try to start thinking that way, because we have to soon.
I think, too, as we're looking at bringing more industry because we need more jobs, what are those jobs actually that fit the community? Not what's popular, not what looks good on paper, but how is it going to feed the community? And then are we going to offer the proper training needed so that we can get people back to work? And then also we're going to pay people a living wage, a wage that is fair, that also gives them opportunities to grow their families, and so that they don't have to collect silver for their children to not be left in debt, you know? But, you know, I look at, I think, in Blacksburg, which I think Torque Robotics, and then I just forgot the name of the other industry that's kind of expanding. Though I see those as the types of industries and jobs that are going to be good for who we are and where we are and what the skill sets are of our community. And I think that we all need to look at that, but well-being is certainly important.
Well, and I think that's, you know, it reminds me of a story with Google a while back where the CEO, one of the founders, whose name I'm blanking on, had to step down because of corporate bylaws and the way that having a board and all that stuff works. If you're the CEO, if you're making decisions that aren't profitable for the country, it doesn't matter what, or the company, what, how philosophically sound they are, like, hey, we're not going to filter our search results just so we can have Google in China Well, that's bad for the bottom line. So he had to step down as CEO of a company he started because of a philosophical difference. And I get it. If I was a businessman doing these things. But the reality is, when you don't grow a company, whether it's Google, whether it's the mom and pop shop on the corner, whatever else, if you don't grow them in a way that's sustainable, if you do things that are fast and cheap and best for just probably the person who owns the company, mm-hmm. they're not going to be around very long. Mm-hmm. And what you're going to end up with is a bunch of employees that see their boss out hunting lions, whether you're Jimmy John's or another like local place, and you're like, yo, why am I getting paid $20,000 less than I'm worth a year when this guy's like jet setting to go kill endangered species? Mm. And you know, and I mean, again, think about someone at Jimmy John's, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a sandwich artist at this like, you know, place or whatever, and I'm getting paid minimum wage. My boss is actively fighting legislation to raise minimum wage. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, he's buying guns to kill things that the guns cost more than I make in 2 years.
Yeah.
And so, again, it's that kind of, I mean, I hate to make it like a whole class rich versus poor issue, but that's what it comes down to when it comes to growing these companies and doing the right thing. Mm. You know, is someone going to make millions of dollars, or is someone going to make $1 million and have a bunch of happy employees and a long-term business plan?
I think in regards to what is happening with these businesses leaving, I think our leadership in this region needs to be a little bit more creative in trying to locate industries coming mm-hmm. into this, and really look at the talent that we have in this area and then find industries based on the talent we have. I understand before we try to bring in businesses and then we train the talent and we try to build up the talent. But I think with the recent departures, I think it's important that first we really need to look at, okay, what kind of talent do we have in the city? And then see if we can find industries that we can align ourselves with. And then and once we do that, and if new industries come in, then yes, we can start preparing our people and train them and move forward. But right now, you know, there's a tax deficiency. Mm-hmm. tax bases, they're losing their tax yeah. base. And so uh-huh. I think leadership really need to start being a little bit more creative in mm-hmm. their thinking. And I'm a small businessman. I'm always creative how to make sure we pay bills.
I can attest to that. 100%.
You have to be creative and nimble. And I think our leadership and I think the region have to start thinking that way and being nimble and to solve some of our economic
yeah.
issues.
I mean, I will say the one thing that was smart was they invested in that water. You know, they have an entire, like, they put all the water resources into like one board or something mm-hmm. like that. So they have like the water region. Mm-hmm. And I think that was smart. But then we see, you know, a lot of people playing that up with the MVP, you know, trying to, you know, oppose the pipelines because of that. So I do see some sustainability in certain efforts. You know, when you're putting your efforts into, you know, good infrastructure for water, I think that's, you know, solid. But then also, you know, if we're saying, okay, we need, you know, we have a bunch of folks who are coming out of like old industrial coal jobs, you know, where can we put those people to work to get our community infrastructure up to where we want our community infrastructure to mm-hmm. be, to have our community infrastructure be sustainable, mm-hmm. right? Like I see a lot of, you know, crumbling school buildings, or if we have, you know, in terms of our storm water, you know, all these things that if we have people coming out of those jobs, well, let's, you know, absorb them into creating a nice infrastructure so that we're renewing ourselves, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So we just have to be, I think we also have to be smart in terms of how we look at our own capital government investments mm-hmm. For the long term, too.
Okay. All right. Let's move forward. Let's talk about healthcare. The cost of paying for health care. University of Virginia Health System, we learned, has that over 6 years, ending in June 2018, the health system and its doctors sued former patients more than 36,000 times for over $106 million. They're seizing wages and bank accounts, putting liens on property and homes, and forcing families into bankruptcy. Kaiser Health News analysis has found, and more news for Purdue Pharma and e-cigarettes related to more deaths. So what's the net effect of what looks like a health crisis in more than one way?
I think it's very simple. And again, it comes down to money. If I was holding a gun to someone's head and said, sign this contract, you're going to sign the contract. But if you won't hold up in court because you signed it under distress, right? If I'm sick in the emergency room, it doesn't matter if I'm dying or not. If I feel like I'm dying, I don't care how much things cost.
Right.
And this happened to me. You know, I got a kidney stone. And what I owed after the kidney stone was around $3,700 for fluids and a CAT scan. And that was basically all I got when I went to the emergency room. To avoid paying that amount of money, I go to my doctor and I say, hey, what can I do so this doesn't happen again? Well, I don't know. Thanks for giving us some money, but we need you to give this other person some more money now. And you go to the other person. And in the meantime, while you're waiting to see the specialist, you have another kidney stone, so you owe more money. And you go to the specialist, and you're like, what do I do about this? And I'm like, well, you know, there's not a lot we can do about it except give us more money. Well, can you give me medication, or can you give me some kind of plan of something to do so that if it does happen again, I don't have to pay all this money? No, you're just really going to have to keep going to the emergency room whenever this happens and keep giving us more money. And it's a racket, you know? And so, I mean, you see this, like, there wouldn't be this whole system of lawyers and debt collection if it wasn't designed to be like that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't designed to make all this money. And again, what you're preying on are people who desperately need help. It's not like you go to UVA because your cancer's going all right. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to these places because you need desperate, specialized help. Mm-hmm. And while those people are very specialized and they probably do a great job at their jobs, it's the business corporate side of it that is going, they are really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we could charge people twice as much? Mm-hmm. Got it.
Yeah, I think, you know, nobody goes to the emergency room just because. Like, it's not fun. Nobody wants to go to the emergency room. And so when you are doing the things, particularly, and I get you have to be paid. I mean, people have to be paid for their services, and I get that. I think that's important. But when you're looking at making a person's health worse by attacking their wages, which 9 times out of 10, if they haven't been paying your bills, it's because they're not in a position to do so. If you're trying to take away their homes, like, what are you doing? So you're making probably what was a desperate situation
worse.
Yeah. And so we have to look at all of this, because this health crisis that we're in is mind, body, soul, and pocketbook.
Yeah. You know? As somebody married to an emergency physician, I know so first off, the important thing to know is that, like, the emergency department, they are going to see you and take care of you no matter what. Like, they're required by law to not care about whether or not you can pay. And most people who go into emergency medicine go into it because they have that kind of attitude, like, that I don't, you know, they're not your, you know, elective surgeon type people. They're the type of people who are like, no, I want to be there for you in your time of need, like, to say, hey, I'm going to help you out and get you through this. And, you know, they, you know, ruin, you know, their own health is, you know, affected by having to be up at all hours of the night. And that's part of the job. And they really go into it for those purposes. And I see two kind of levels of sort of malevolence here. One is UVA itself. Like, UVA did not need to be taking all this money. You know, in that story itself, Carilion Clinic was very clear, like, we don't do this. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason they don't is because very early on, when they transitioned over into that not-for-profit model, the Roanoke Times did a couple stories on them where they were still doing their old, like, for-profit collection model. And when they, you know, when they were, you know, just a corporation, straight up, regular corporation, and they changed that policy pretty quick after some bad PR that was pretty low level. And they save themselves a lot of heartache in doing that because they write off a lot of care and they can do that. That, you know, you have in the not-for-profit model, that's the benefit of it is that you can then use that to say, well, I don't pay taxes. And this is part of the reason why is because, you know, I provide this charity care. Mm-hmm. Well, UVA wanted to get all those benefits of not paying taxes, but they wanted to then get all the money that they possibly could, and they were being greedy instead of, you know, writing off that care. And then the other level of greed you have are the insurance companies. So the insurance companies and just the whole model of, you know, everybody negotiating and not having, you know, one provider of insurance. Like when you don't just have like, okay, the government's going to give you an option for insurance and negotiate prices and have kind of like a more set thing. That's when you get into this, oh, well, you're not, UVA is out of network for us, or, you know, this surgeon's out of network. Well, there should be no such thing. It's out of network in America. Right. No, like we should end that. Like that should be over. So, you know, a lot of these folks were stuck with, you know, out of network, twice as expensive as it would have been if the insurance company would have been the one on the hook. Mm-hmm. And so we just see these levels of greed in healthcare where you're right. You really need it. You need the care and you deserve it. And the emergency department has to be open 24/7, no matter what. So they are there for you. Right. So, and you have to have enough patients to keep it open. So like, there's really nothing, you know, kidney stone folks, like if you have a kidney stone in the middle of the night, like that is where you need to, like, that's a great place for you to be to like get care because, you know, the emergency department is open no matter what. So, you know, like even seeing some people who are like marginal is no problem there. So it's complicated, but, you know, UVA was super greedy and this is super gross. And I think part of it is that, you know, they wanted to, you know, keep their prestige and funnel it into, you know, their health system dollars to, like, you know, do pay more researchers or whatever. I have no idea, but whatever they were doing with the money, but they were just being too greedy.
Well, yeah. And to be clear, I mean, it's just like with when we're talking about 9/11, right? We can be critical of the politicians and be very supportive of the troops and everyone else. Like, I, you know, my mom was just in the emergency room this week. We had a lovely doctor named Lou who was doing his, like, damnedest to make sure everything was going to be okay with her and was taking care of 50 million other people at the same time. So, I mean, the service is great. And the service, you know, the people providing it, I do believe, are all good people. It's just that a system that is designed to make profit or is to charge for things is always going to grow in the direction that makes them money. So it's sort of the difference between, you know, like a bank and a credit union, or like someone who wants to do financial investing for you, but fiduciary, is that the name of the ones who are actually looking out for your interest rather than
fiduciary?
Yeah. So a fiduciary, you know, investor versus just someone who wants to make money off your money. I think once you start, again, like with Krillion, once you start rethinking the model like a credit union, like a way that, again, is more sustainable for people, that's how you retain your clients. That's how you retain growth. And it's how you keep people happy. And again, it goes back to what we were just talking about last one. Sustainable growth is the way to do it. How many people aren't going to go to UVA now and go to the Mayo Clinic or somewhere else and pay all this extreme amounts of money just because of this kind of bad decision they made?
Right.
And so while they think lots of times that this is the responsible way to make money and this is the best way to make money, long term, it becomes a big issue.
Yeah, I know a couple family members have driven to UVA because of their medical issues. And, you know, and one of them in particular has a huge medical bill from this. And so we're constantly, you know, it's like, what do we do? Do I go back and making sure that working with cancer, they have cancer, and going back up there and they see this big bill and they start questioning, okay, what's the value of my life? really.
Yeah.
And that is the worst thing that you will have to make a decision on.
Right.
And it's crazy.
We shouldn't put people in these situations.
You shouldn't have to have that kind of conversation with yourself and your family members with that.
I mean, if we had just like a normal, sane healthcare system, like, I mean, in the UK, like in Canada, like they have emergency departments. People go there. Like some of them are like serious, some of them aren't, and they just take care of it. Like they're just like, okay, you know, it's triaged. Like you're serious, you're not. We, you know, they work through it, well, and nobody gets a surprise bill.
I don't know how you like waiting 15 months to see a doctor about a cold, but that's how it works in
Canada,
in England. Yeah. Communist up in Canada.
If you have a cold for 15 months, we have a larger problem.
Yeah, pretty much.
What? Where do we leave off at?
Suicide. All right.
So, Karen, you're going to start our... Okay, let's Brad, start editing. Pick back up where Robert left off here with suicide.
All right.
So September is National Suicide Month.
Yes. Yeah. All right. So this is September. September is National Suicide Prevention Month. And I believe all of our lives have been affected either directly or indirectly by suicide. I can speak personally. Just recently, a friend committed suicide, a high school friend, and you know, I had a range of emotions about that and still do. So I guess one of the big questions is, what can we do to prevent suicide, or can we?
It is preventable. That is one of the biggest myths about suicide, is that it's not preventable, that people are just going to go ahead and do it. And it's, that is not accurate at all. That's one of the big, huge myths. It's all about creating, basically people very quickly can become suicidal, and act on their, and act on that impulse. And so it's for people who, the smart thing is to kind of create an environment where you have lowered the risk for everybody. Mm-hmm. So one thing I do, you know, we don't have guns in the house. You know, another thing you can do is lock up a gun if you have one in the house. Keep it inaccessible. If anybody's having, you know, increased anxiety, increased relationship stress, offer to take a friend's firearm, or to, you know, if they have access to medications. Medications are much less lethal because you have that moment after you take it where you can reconsider. And that's the other thing, too. So that's why guns and, other methods, guns are really the most lethal method. But, you know, there's some other lethal methods, where you don't have that moment of reconsideration. Mm-hmm. So any moment where you don't have that moment of reconsideration are the really dangerous ones, where you can kind of put the brakes on things. But medications, you actually have that moment and, you know, go to the ER, get there and get treated. And it's only, most people who have an attempt don't go on to reattempt. So surviving that one attempt is really critical. So that's the one thing I would say, is that people don't necessarily remain, you know, I think there's a myth of attempt, and then someone's successful and they'll always find a way, but that's not at all accurate.
Yeah, and I think it's in part our stigmatizing mental health and having any kind of mental health issue that's seen as a weakness or as a problem that you can't talk about, you can't do something about. So whether it's, I think there's a lot of things you can do, you know, including keeping people safe from things that cause them harm. Long-term, you know, be an advocate and someone who's open to listening to other people, to help with other people, you know, feel okay talking to people, because, you know, no one, despite, I think, lots of times how people feel, whether it's depression, anxiety, or whatever else that leads people to suicide. Mm-hmm. You're not bothering people. People care about you. And in fact, talking to people, if you're having those kind of feelings, often brings relief to the person you're talking to, because there's a conversation about it, and there's a road to health and recovery and whatever else. And I think it does a world of good just to be open and honest about those things.
Mm-hmm. I've been thinking a lot about, like, when you are in the depths of it, like whatever the it is for you that has you in that space, how do we help people kind of through that?
Because
I would gander that when you are in the depths of the it, that it happens when you're most alone, you know, by yourself, you know, in your home. And
connectivity mm-hmm. is a huge, it's one indicator of like how high suicide will be in a community. So the more connected a community and the more connected a person is, then that protects them. Now there's one small caveat to that, which is that if you're connected to a person who has died by suicide, then you are at increased risk for a period of time after that. So the other thing I would say is like right now, consider everyone who was like close to the person who died by suicide to be at increased risk and be like checking in on them and connecting to them. And just men are they need to feel, that people are open to hear them struggling. Mm. Like, we don't let guys struggle. We don't let guys say, like, I don't have it all together. I don't have a plan. I don't have it figured out. I'm feeling horrible right now. I feel like I just want to lie on my floor and never get up again. And we don't let guys, like, just have that. And women have just as many, suicide problems, but actually are much less successful. They're much more successful at survival. So because they're more connected, because they choose less lethal means. We do need to put the focus on guys, especially to give them that connectedness, give them that like, hey, you don't have to have a plan. You don't have to have your life figured out. All we need you to do is to be here tomorrow. Like, that's all we need from you. We don't need anything more. We don't need you to support your family. We don't need you to, we don't need you to have a plan to do this or that right now. We don't need you to have it all together.
Yeah, I think because a lot of those kind of, for lack of a better term, sort of sexist pressures that people have and how women are a lot better about being open and in touch with how they're feeling. That idea makes complete sense to me, or that whether it's a statistic or whatever else. I think I think one of the things that always helped me, because I have terrible ADD. I don't know if anyone's listened to this show and can obviously tell, but like,
yes, we can.
I was really resistant for a long time about figuring out therapeutic ways, whether it's seeing a counselor and figuring out strategies to deal with it, or being on medication. And I finally had a therapist once tell me, it happened to be a buddy of mine, so it was another great form of reaching out. He said, he's like, well, if you had really bad allergies and you couldn't control the things that you were allergic to, would someone get really mad at you if you took Claritin every day? Do you think people would look down on you for taking Claritin? And I was like, nah, not at all. And he's like, well, why don't you just take some stupid ADD medicine then? I'm like, right. Or just mm-hmm. listen to your counselor, or just do the things, that'll help with that. And that really changed the way I thought about that. And I think, depression and suicide, and especially with men, everyone I know who has unfortunately been successful or has attempted suicide was alone. Lots of them were in a place where they worked, their shop, or somewhere late at night. Again, they were isolating. And looking back on those things, you can go, oh, yeah, it was really obvious. And I think it is kind of common sense. It can be that obvious. Like, this person is having a lot of conversations with themselves very late at night on Facebook. They're isolating. They won't answer their phone. Those are the times I think, again, people can go, yeah, this is kind of getting to that, troubled water of like, oh, I'm just a burden. And the kind of train of thought that leads to taking those kind of more fatal actions. And so, again, reaching out and, again, being open about how you feel and sometimes being vulnerable mm-hmm. about it, can really be the road to fixing
it. I can say that one thing that is also a huge myth is that burden myth. Because I can say that my cousin has carried the burden of her father's suicide with her entire life, and that he has, like, that burden has never left her, that he, that emotional burden. And so if you think that you're going to like lessen the burden that way, like, that's just utterly false. And just, to remind people that the best way to, to honor the people that care about you is to continue. Just it doesn't mean you have to continue in any sort of certain, like, meeting any certain mark. Just to still be here is the most important thing, because mm-hmm. she misses him. There was the burden of having to just emotionally deal with all that when she was in high school and a teenager, and it was a lot. Mm-hmm. It's a lot to deal with.
Yeah, you were talking about listening, and right after I found out about my friend committing suicide, I found this quote that just hit me in a certain way, it says, deep listening is the kind of listening that can help relieve the suffering of another person. You can call it compassionate listening. You listen with only one purpose, to help him or her empty his heart. And unfortunately, I can't pronounce the man's name that
did this quote.
Yeah. Thich Nhat Hanh. I think he's a Buddhist monk, I believe. But I read that and you were talking about listening, Will. And for us to be there and to be present, because I know that with my friend and talking with our other friends, because when you're from a small town, we all started in kindergarten, graduated high school together. You know, we all went through, and even though some had stayed more connected, we were all still connected and talking with everyone. There were, I think, attempts of my friend to reach out, but because he appeared to have it all together, right? And was always the person to listen to everyone else. I think it perhaps could have been harder for him. So I think that listening piece for all of us is really important.
Yeah, and I think being an active listener is an extremely... we're so used to people being on their phones, being distracted by whatever. It's your birthday, so someone sends you like the automated, you know, happy birthday on LinkedIn or Facebook or whatever.
LinkedIn.
Like, it doesn't really like count, you know, like it's the difference between, you know, sending someone a text and an emoji and calling them and or going over to where they're at and meeting them there and, you know, looking someone in the eye and talking to them. And I think that idea of active listening is extremely important. And especially, you know, sometimes, especially if there's a family that's dealing with someone who has a lot of these issues, you know, lots of times they're also dealing with compassion fatigue. So it's important as friends, you know, family, whatever else, the community, to kind of be aware of that too and step in when you know, that circle needs help also.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that leads us, you know, back to some of what we were talking earlier is that a lot of these pressures and a lot of these things that are often in people's heads are constructs of our society, right? Like your life only has value if you can provide and make money. If you are going to cost people money, or you're going to not be able to do the things that are assumed of you because of, like, well, you know, you're a man and you go to high school and you go to college and then you get the job working for the nice boss and then you work your way up through nice boss company and then you retire and play golf. I mean, think about all the people who die, whether it's not directly by suicide, but just letting themselves
work to death.
Yeah. Or once they're done working, they're like, well, crap, what do I do now? Because I bought into this myth my entire life. And a year after I've retired, I've let my health decline and drinking, and I die at a ripe age of 60. If you can retire at 60.
That's the
most fictitious part about that thing I made up.
60
is the new 24.
70 and a half, absolutely. I mean, I think we just... We need to let some of these myths go, like especially of like the idealizing the businessman. Like, what I like to do is just absolutely think in my mind about Bill Gates and how horrible he is. Like, I just like to, like, I just, you know, all his quote unquote.
Who's the GE guy? Because he's like the number one, like, poster boy. Jack Welch.
In my mind. Well, and you can substitute any of these billionaire guys in here. In my mind, I'm like, what that was so great, you know, has, like, you know, I appreciate, like, you know, being able to order things off Amazon, but like the environmental damage that some of these companies create, or the political damage that Facebook has created, like, these people just go out and they do, and like they really are like smash. I almost view it like really successful highway robbers, like smash and grab. Like, they grab the money and then they run away and they're like, oh, too bad about all that damage.
But
sorry about
that.
Would
it be cool if you had billions of dollars? I know.
So what I like to think
the American dream, you get rich.
I know. But what I like to remind myself is that they jet set around to Davos, and that later their children are all going to hate them because of all the environmental damage they've created. And they're just going to be, history is going to remember these guys as the worst.
Well,
So then I'm like, I'm glad I'm not rich. And then when, and then anytime I think about having any sort of power, I'm like, but I don't have the temperament for that. So I'm real glad I don't. it really keeps my ambitions at bay.
Well, but this is the philosophy of things, right? It's like, you know, this idea that you're not supposed to enjoy your job, that the mm-hmm. measure of success within your job is how much money you can make. And by proxy, how just really much money you made your company and all the like green you put them in. And really, like, that's not an actual measure for success. And I think, again, that plays into that narrative about what success is. Mm-hmm. And then that again feeds into us being depressed or, mm-hmm. I think one of the huge aspects of that too is, you know, depression doesn't always latch onto reason or logic.
No.
Right. As same with anxiety and whatever else. And so when you have all these models for success and for being a good father, being a good mother, being a good employee, whatever else, that just aren't real, that again, and ultimately benefit someone else's ability to jet set to Davos or whatever else, you know, you're going to end up with a lot of broken people. And then you combine that with a system that doesn't prioritize mental health at all.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Yeah.
You know, I think some of the best way to avoid, you know, people getting sick and calling into work or getting hurt or whatever else is to make sure that they're happy, healthy people, you know, mm-hmm. in their minds as much as their bodies.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that's just not something we do.
And I mean, we talk about, like, you know, even going back to like the workers, you know, who responded to 9/11, you know, we talk about, okay, you know, they work so hard, but we made them work these long shifts. We actually did not, like, we could have called in more people to spread the burden further,
mm-hmm.
but we chose not to. Like, we chose to give them cancer. We chose to expose them to these things. Like, these were all choices of mm-hmm. people in charge mm-hmm. that chose to say, okay, we're going to max out your PTSD.
Yeah.
We're going to make it so that you have the maximum level of damage from this event.
Yeah.
And we didn't need to do that. We could have just, I mean, we, you know, we talk about the unemployment rate, but then we never think like, well, you know, we could just spread out the burden of work a little further instead of all having to work ourselves to death.
No, but it's a bottom line thing. It's
yeah.
it
comes yeah, yeah,
to profit
exactly.
and what then costs have, more or less.
Yeah, mm-hmm. what costs less to yeah. pay fewer people a little, you know, pay them a little extra overtime to kill themselves. Yeah,
right.
Perfect.
But we also are making choices to not take care of the mental health issues. Right.
Oh, yeah.
I think I read an article with the VA, you know, about suicides. And then we're seeing an increase of suicides among farmers. Right. And so we're doing all these things also that are exasperating the situation, but then not doing any of the care or providing the care, you know, that's necessary and needed. And so I think it's really important we take away that stigma. I think for men,
oh,
and
yeah.
I will preface this with white male men, for black people
yeah.
of color. I mean, it's a huge stigma to talk about what's going on, like what's really wrong. You know, people are always talking about check on your strong friend.
Yeah.
The ones sure. that look like they have it all together are probably the ones that really don't, you know. I just watched Dave Chappelle and was cracking up. But, you know, he's talking about suicide and, you know, looking at Anthony Bourdain and then a friend of his and kind of the contrast of what made Anthony Bourdain commit suicide, but his friend who had gone through a whole lot of struggles to not, right?
Yeah.
But it's because we all deal with, you know, things differently. But I think that it's incumbent on all of us to
yeah.
super.
And there's that. There's
be
that
aware.
Pressure now also with social media mm-hmm. to present as that strong person.
Yeah.
Like, you know, to never admit that you're the person who like lies on the floor some days and is like, nope,
yeah.
not today.
Like, I cannot stand, I do not like for people to see me cry. And so if you see me cry, then you know that there is something.
Yeah.
But
well, I'm glad you brought up Dave Chappelle, though, because I was thinking of a creative way to wrap him into this, like, speaking
yeah.
of mental health. He does have a thing in there. You know, it's interesting, you know, when you were talking about the rate of suicide between white men and black men. Like, there's an interesting thing he says in there about how when he was talking to his dad about being poor, his dad referred to being poor as a temporary thing, as a state that they were in, not something that defines them as a person. And so, you know, when someone's going to go bankrupt and they're, you know, they're white, they're going to lose their house or whatever else, you know, I think the way that, that often the black community looks at this is much better than the way that the white community does, which is like, oh my God, bankruptcy is going to be the end of the world. Like, we're going to, you know, we're going to lose the house, and then what are we going to do? And then those kind of like illusionary pressures that lead to suicide, mm-hmm. That lead to those kind of extreme behaviors and reactions to things that, again, at the end of the day, it's just money. Like, it, and again, right. it's important and whatever else, but you know, ultimately the value of your life is worth more than any kind of hospital bill or any kind of, you know, measure of success when it comes to your paycheck.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I love everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, oh, one final thing. I know we've probably been a little messy about this in here, but I do know from the mental health experts that they like to say a certain thing, which is hard for me to remember because it's not the common thing. But they like to say, when you talk about suicide, to say died by suicide instead of committed suicide, because there's something about how you say it. I think they've tested this, and the idea is that committed, it sounds like an accomplishment,
right?
Like, oh, they finally did it, like, you know, there's some sort of like accomplishment to it. But died by suicide, it takes away the you know, it takes away some of the stigma, I think, because it says, okay, just like you can die of kidney disease, you can die of suicide, like, that this is something that happened to you, but like, it's somewhat helpful in that you don't think of it necessarily, then your relatives don't necessarily think of it, and the people closest to you don't necessarily think of it as, oh, this is something they chose, but they see it as a conflagration of factors, just like you would with any other disease and environmental things that happened, mm-hmm. and this person, you know, died by suicide, instead of saying that it was really an active choice on their part, because, like, I guess the doctors don't really see it, or, you know, the mental health professionals don't really see it as an active choice. They see it more as an environmental, like, conflagration of events that happens to you.
Makes sense.
And that you are sort of in that moment susceptible to that environment that you're in. I don't know if I'm making sense, but
no, but
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it is important the way that we talk about and label things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the industry at large is just now starting to actively acknowledge burnout.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because they lose a lot of good employees, and sadly, it's about bottom line. But again, it is a big step, because burnout, as having a term for it at work, is not just like, well, they're just working too much, they just don't like their job, they're just not happy at work. All this kind of, you know, mm-hmm. these silly ideas about your mental health. Calling burnout a real thing is similar to saying, you know, they died by suicide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, committing suicide is just like, well, they gave up.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of that tone to it that they worry about. Yeah. So even though it's so common, you know, it's so common, it's super hard to change it. Like, it's very, very difficult when you hear a certain phrase over and over and over again for 40 years mm-hmm. to change how you're speaking. But they do ask, you know, they are asking us to try to make that active change. So I'm going to mention it. So,
yeah, so
just, if you can, say died by suicide.
Died by suicide. Yeah. So we just want everyone to know that we're here for you.
Woo!
Yes, we are 100% here for you.
Even Bill Gates.
Even Bill Gates.
Especially Bill Gates.
No.
Welch, whomever. We are.
Right. Money will not prevent this. That is true.
Yeah, we're here. And if you are, you know, needing help, seeking help, there are plenty of resources out there. You can hit us up. We will certainly direct you to the right place.
Yeah, and and I'm sure wherever you're hearing this or watching this, we can put a lot of links in the description, comments, whatever else, if you're out there, or just call one of us.
Yeah.
We're around.
Yeah, always. So we're coming to the conclusion of today, and as always, we kind of end it with talking about what we're looking forward to for this week. And so I am gonna do men's first instead of ladies first. So Will, that's
it. Always
you.
Works so much better, because I don't know until people start talking, and then I can, like, oh yeah. This week, what am I looking forward to? What's going on in the world? I don't know. I'm looking forward to hearing from you guys, because then I'll know. I was in the ER Monday night with a family member to like 5 in the morning, and it just wiped out all my short term memory. So, feel free to start, and I'll catch up.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you guys what I'm actually looking for. So this Friday at the Moss Center, Dance Theater of Harlem is performing. Ooh. So I think that's going to be amazing. Along with Henry Street is on Saturday. Make sure that you go out to the Henry Street Festival. It's something that's always been near and dear to me because it's been going on for as long as I can remember. And I think it's one of the highlights of Roanoke. So,
and we got Drew Hill this year, right?
Yes. And so, as always, I will be right up front at the stage. So if you see me, I will be singing my little heart out because that is what I do best.
Well, in Henry Street, you know, a big shout out to the Harrison.
Absolutely.
And everything in the sphere around that great museum. You know, Henry Street, I think, was really important for a long time. And again, I'm speaking as a white person. Because there was this idea in Roanoke that you could only bring country bands here, mm-hmm. that people only want to hear like old rock guys or the Beatles or whatever else. And Henry Street was really one of the best organizations, and TAP also eventually with their summer concerts, to be like, you know what? There's a whole other big portion of the city that doesn't actually like country music, guys. I don't know if anybody told you guys.
Maybe they do like a little country music, but not all the time.
At your white dude entertainment company. But turns out
we can broaden our horizons. Yeah.
Yes.
Black people and white people love Drew Hill.
Yeah.
And it's more than just going, well, only white people come out for, you know, I can't even make up a dumb country
I think our entertainment industry has definitely broadened beyond that, thank goodness.
Absolutely. Yeah, but I think that started with Henry Street.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah,
definitely. Showing, you know, what happens when you... when you do listen to the people in your community.
Yeah. That's a thought.
So, I know that's new for our show.
Right.
So my thing that I'm looking forward to is this Thursday at 7:30, I'm going to be watching the Democratic debate party. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be at a watch party with Roanoke Indivisible and the Roanoke Young Democrats. And it's going to be at Food Fanatics Kitchen, which has some lovely, I like their jalapeno pizza that they have. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of that. And that's over there at 7:30 this Thursday, and I'm going to be seeing what they say. Let's find out.
Yeah, I'm a fair weather Democrat because I'm just like, I'm just going to wait until there's like 5.
Well, we're still at like 10.
Right. Who we got?
Some have been dropping out. I know that Kirsten
Gillibrand dropped out.
Yeah. The fact that I can't say her name right was probably a sign.
Yeah, yeah. But I think, like, de Blasio, he didn't make the debate stage, so he's still going to try for another one and then make a decision. Yeah. I think he needs to probably bow out. I think, I forgot the other guy's name.
Beto
is still going strong.
Mayor Pete?
Yeah.
Mayor Pete is still going strong. Beto was just here. He was in Blacksburg and in Roanoke.
Well, shout out to Beto for actually coming out here.
Yeah.
But one person who is very smart commented to me about Beto that this is someone who's paid for their political analysis and their, you know, they teach politics as like classes at Tech. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, it's kind of weird that he's here and not in Iowa. And she was like, so I don't know what he's aiming for. So her thought was, then we were sort of chatting about it a little bit, and she's like, I don't think he's really aiming to be president anymore.
Elizabeth Warren, speaking of, is the only person who responded to RuPaul, who I love. So good for her. Big shout out to her.
I
wasn't really entirely on the fence about her. I think she's the only candidate. RuPaul's having some kind of debate. And she's the only one who has said, like, a resounding like, yes, I will totally do whatever you need me to do, RuPaul, for the community.
Oh, and so, I love that.
Yeah, good for her. Big shout out to her.
Yeah.
Her stock, I think, just went up for me.
When people invite you to come and talk to them, I think you should always, let me rephrase that, not always say yes, but you should definitely say yes. You should talk to the people, especially if you want to represent them.
Yeah.
I'm fighting a battle in the NRV with folks not wanting to show up to stuff, but that's okay. We'll deal with that another time. So
I'm a big Warren stan, I'll admit it. I got the sticker on my car.
All right.
What do you think the ticket? I mean,
I don't know what's going to happen.
I have this sort of fevered wish that it's like, it's Warren and somebody, you know, whether it's Bernie or Pete or
So I will say this out loud that I am not a Bernie fan.
That's fine.
And like, not at all. Like, even though, and I get chastised for this all the time, so I did vote for him in the primary against Hillary Clinton, but that was a protest vote because I didn't like the process. True. But I am really not a Bernie fan. So I am on the fence with everybody right now because I have some issues with where everybody kind of stands on some different things. But I think at the same time, I like all of them.
Sure.
Like, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
You know, I just don't know how it's going to shake out. Mm-hmm. But, and I'm a little scared, as usual, about that. But we shall see. Right now, it doesn't feel too, it feels early.
It's too early. Yeah.
Is it, though?
Yeah. I mean, it's way early.
It's almost November 2019.
I mean, this is like, I mean, like, you know, in 2015, Donald Trump, like, came down the stairs and got weird, like, in, what, September?
Yeah.
I do want it whittled down, though, before the first primary, right? Because I don't want a primary with, like, 8,000 candidates on there. I want to see who are my top 3 to 4.
Yeah.
And see how that shakes out.
Yeah, and, it's, you know, speaking of having a bunch of fringe people in debates, we really need to take a hard lesson from the Republican debates. Because I think that's in part why you ended up with Donald Trump. It's because you let everybody cannibalize each other.
He was the only one who could...
Yeah. He was like, I'm the best at cannibalizing
people.
In a people.
Crowd, yes. He could pull enough attention, and it was a literal crowd up on the stage, and he could make a few memorable moments, and like, not that anything that he said made sense or was good ideas, but he could make, you know, that 30-second splice, and mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't need that. We don't
do
need,
not need that.
30-second campaigning.
No.
Although, you know, and again, it made me, and maybe it worked. I felt favorable for Jeb Bush because of what a nightmare the GOP primary process was.
You're the only one.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying, I was just like, man, oh my God. Look at all these sociopaths. Like, at least this one was raised to be a sociopath.
Oh, gosh.
Y'all are killing me. All right. And Robert, you want to close us out now?
Well, it's been a great discussion, and thank you for all of you for participating in today. And thank you for listening to Our Voices, Our Community, presented by Colors VA Magazine. You can also listen to us each Sunday at 3 p.m. on WROE 95.7, Radio Free Roanoke. If you like what you have heard today, leave us a review. Also, be sure to like Our Voices, Our Community on Facebook. Thank you and have a blessed day.
If you or someone you know is in an emergency, call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255, or call 911 immediately. Suicidal thoughts, much like mental health conditions, can affect anyone regardless of age, gender, or background. In fact, suicide is often the result of an untreated mental health condition. Suicidal thoughts, although common, should not be considered normal and often indicate more serious issues. In 2016 alone, nearly 45,000 individuals died by suicide, leaving behind their friends and family members to navigate the tragedy of loss. In many cases, friends and families affected by a suicide loss, often called suicide loss survivors, are left in the dark. Too often, the feelings of shame and stigma prevent them from talking openly. September is National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, a time to share resources and stories in an effort to shed light on this highly taboo and stigmatized topic. We use this month to reach out to those affected by suicide, raise awareness, and connect individuals with suicidal ideation to treatment services. It is also important to ensure that individuals, friends, and families have access to the resources they need to discuss suicide prevention. The National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, is here to help. The number again to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255.